The story is almost unbelievable.
To lose four beautiful girls who are in a place of safety, I still cry.
Most of the information in the files at the state and local level was just useless. It was investigating the theory that the blacks had blown their own church up to somehow get sympathy for their cause.
People clammed up. Everywhere you turned, the Klan was saying, I don't know anything about it. And because of that, the case just couldn't be made.
The bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church occurred on September 15, 1963. But it took decades to put the perpetrators on trial. I'm Greg Bass, and this hour we'll talk with former Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxley and former U.S. Attorney Doug Jones, the prosecutors who eventually brought the guilty to justice. We'll also speak with journalist Barnett Wright, author T.K. Thorne, and with Barbara Cross, who survived the church bombing. This is Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, The Case for Justice. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. called Birmingham the most segregated city in America. In 1963, it became the epicenter of the civil rights struggle. Birmingham's racist public safety commissioner, Eugene Bull Connor, and Alabama Governor George Wallace became the faces of white resistance to integration. Marches filled the streets of Birmingham, and protesters filled the jails. Black schoolchildren played a prominent part in the demonstrations and were often arrested. Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church became a central gathering place for the movement.
One frame of reference now is some of the Middle Eastern countries. When you think about the bombings that are taking place there, that's the type of atmosphere that blacks in Birmingham were living in 1963 and prior.
Barnett Wright is a reporter for the Birmingham News and the author of 1963, How the Birmingham Civil Rights Movement Changed America and the World.
You just never knew when a bomb would go off out in front of your house, in your garage, or horrifically in a church. If someone is going to bomb a church, you could never tell where a bomb would go off. Wherever blacks were congregating, those are places where bombs could have gone off. The 16th Street Baptist Church was a very popular meeting place. Even before the children's marches, the mass meetings, it was a focal point for a lot of what was going on in Birmingham. So because of that, because of the history of the church, it became a target for the bombers.
The Ku Klux Klan was actively involved in suppressing the civil rights movement, and their members were linked to many bombings in and around Birmingham. But before September 15, 1963, no one had been killed in any of those bombings. That was about to change.
A love that forgives, from Matthew 5th chapter, and I think it started at the 38th verse, about forgiving your enemies, turning the other cheek.
After 50 years, Barbara Cross still recalls the Sunday school lesson from that day at the 16th Street Baptist Church. That morning, her father, the Reverend John Cross, was preparing his sermon, and Barbara, who was 13 at the time, was getting ready for Youth Sunday.
Most of the youth that were under 15 were downstairs in the basement area. I was probably, if you were walking in from the outside, going downstairs, my classroom was on the left, and the girls' bathroom was to the right side.
Then at 10:22 a.m. came the blast that changed everything.
I just remember that something hit me in my head, and I remember screaming because I didn't know what it was. I remember smelling the horrible fumes, and everybody was trying to get to a place of safety. That was the most horrific, terrible day I have ever experienced in my life, to lose four friends because of a hate crime. It was an attack on the church. It was attack on the Sunday school. It was attack on innocent children who were not marching in the streets of Birmingham. And then after all of that, it would take four decades before the deaths of my four friends finally came to the court because of racism. And to lose four beautiful girls who were in a place of safety, I still cry. That's what I will always remember. I'll never forget that day.
September on the campus of the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa is ordinarily a time when students begin to focus on the new school year. But 1963 was no ordinary year. And for senior law school student Bill Baxley, Sunday the 15th would set events in motion that would change the course of his life.
Well, I remember vividly exactly everything about where I was. I was over at my fraternity house getting ready to eat lunch, dinner on Sunday, and watch football. And the news came on that there'd been this bombing, and a little later on it came on some children had been killed, and I didn't eat. I lost my appetite. It made me physically ill almost. It'd been a very tumultuous summer, starting in the late spring when Medgar Evers was killed, and the stand in the schoolhouse door and the march on Washington, and then this was the worst of all the horrible things that had occurred.
Did it occur to you at that time that this is something you thought you could do something about someday?
Well, I made a vow to myself that I wanted to do something about it. But what I envisioned at that time was that maybe the FBI would, or the feds would make a case. And what I envisioned doing was coming up to Birmingham and volunteering to run errands, look up law, write memos, bring hot dogs and Cokes and cigarettes and candy or whatever to the agents and the prosecutors. That was what I envisioned being able to do.
As it turned out, Baxley was able to do much more because he had political ambitions. And in 1970, he was elected Attorney General of Alabama. At the age of 29, he was the youngest person ever elected State Attorney General.
Well, shortly after being sworn in, probably in the first 2 weeks, I sent and got the files from the Public Safety Department. And pretty soon after that, I got a copy of the Birmingham Police files and Jefferson County Sheriff's files. And I called in a group of people that I wanted to help and told them I wanted to open a case, an active case, and begin an investigation of the bombing case. And so we started probably in January of 71, early February at the latest.
When did it occur to you to approach the FBI for what they had?
We started finally making some progress on the Chambliss group. And as we dug into that, and as more and more time went on, and we got convinced that finally we were on the right track, it became obvious that the Chambliss group had been the suspects that the FBI knew had done it or thought had done it within literally minutes after the bomb went off. And so we started finding people that said, well, I told this to the FBI back when it happened. And the more that we put it together, the more we realized that we were going to have the cooperation of the FBI. So I went through channels. I thought I had a good record of working with the FBI when I'd been the DA down in Dothan and also as Attorney General so far. And so we put in a request for their cooperation and assistance with our investigation, and I sat back and waited and waited and waited and waited.
And what did you do when you got no response from the FBI?
Well, I'd follow it up. At first gave them the benefit of the doubt, and then at some time around there, Hoover died, and I thought, well, maybe things will change, and so I was probably more patient than I would have been now. And I waited, and weeks turned into months, and months turned into years, and still never got it. They never said no, but they never said yes. And we at the same time were continuing to run down what leads we could, and became more convinced every day that Chambliss and his group had done it, and that the FBI had a lot of information that we needed.
And you turned to an old friend in Washington, D.C. for some help, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a good friend that was originally from Alabama named Jack Nelson, and Jack was one of the top journalists in America. He was the head for many years of the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau. And so I was in Washington on some other business, and Jack and I had gone out, and he asked me if I was still working on that bombing case, and I told him, yeah, but it looked like we were about to have to close it down because I couldn't get any help from the FBI, and I explained the whole thing to him, what had happened. And Jack said, I might can help you with that if you want me to. And I said, sure. So we talked about it a while more, and finally I went back to the hotel. And next morning, fairly early, the phone rang. It was Jack. And Jack said, Baxley, said, do you still, you sure you want me to help you try to get the FBI to work with you on that case? And I said, sure. And he said, all right, I think I can help. I just want to make sure that you said the same thing after you had your coffee that you did after you had six or eight beers last night. And I said, Jack went to work.
According to Baxley, what Jack Nelson did was call the Attorney General of the United States and threatened to run a front-page article in the Los Angeles Times saying the FBI refused to cooperate with the Attorney General of Alabama in the church bombing case.
And within a short time, I got a call from the head of the FBI, special agent in charge here in Birmingham, said that they couldn't let us have the files, but if I would send whoever I wanted up to the FBI office, they'd make a space for him to work and work with us. That was great news. I called in one of my top investigators that had not been working on the case, a guy named Bob Eddy, who's one of the best investigators ever and one of the best human beings ever. And I said, Bob, you hadn't been working on this case, but I want to get a fresh set of eyes on it. I want you to take what we've got, familiarize yourself with that, turn all your other cases over to other people, and go to Birmingham and get you a apartment or a hotel room, whichever you want, state will pay for it, and you stay up there until this case is solved. And so he came up, and they gave him an office in the FBI building, and Bob went to work.
Now, what did Bob Eddy and you find out from the FBI that made the difference in being able to prosecute Dynamite Bob Chambliss?
Well, what we really found out from him mostly was that the people that were already feeding us certain information had been consistent for years, and they had told the FBI that earlier. We didn't really learn that much new, but we corroborated what Bob and our other investigators were turning up on their own. What the FBI did, if Bob knew enough to ask for something, then they'd bring it to him, and they'd show it to him, they'd share it with him. But if he didn't know to ask, they didn't volunteer, and so that's their definition of cooperation and mine are 180 degrees apart. But having said that, now I've got no complaint with the investigative work that the FBI agents on the ground did. They did a magnificent job. My complaint was with the decision makers at a higher level that withheld that information from us, because those investigators that worked the case up did an outstanding job.
Let's talk about some of the witnesses.
There was a lady named Ms. Curtis Glenn. She was from Detroit, but she had been in Birmingham visiting over the weekend of the bombing and was staying at a house right behind the 16th Street Church. It was an alley in between that house and the church, and the night of the bombing, it was hot. And she and some of her hosts were sitting out on a porch overlooking that alley. Of course, it was very dark. And she saw about 2 o'clock in the morning a car pull into that alley. And when the doors opened and the lights came on, she saw 4 white men in there. And one of them got out and went up and did something around the corner of the church. And she was suspicious because of a 4 white men being over there in that neighborhood behind that church at that hour of the night. And so she wrote down the tag number of that car and described it. And so the next morning when the bomb went off, she reported to the FBI. They got in touch with her, or she with them, and she showed them the tag number and described Blanton's car. And then they took her to the FBI office and showed her a lot of pictures of known Klansmen that were their suspects. And she picked out unequivocally only one photograph, and it was Chambliss. She said, I have no doubt this is the guy that was sitting in the front passenger seat of that car, which was Blanton's car. And so she positively ID'd Chambliss as being in Blanton's car at 2 a.m. or approximately 2 a.m. on the night before the bomb went off. Now, how we got her back is another story.
You're listening to Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, The Case for Justice. For WBHM, I'm Greg Bass. We're talking with former Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxley, who prosecuted Robert Chambliss in the first trial of the bombers of the 16th Street Baptist Church. Baxley explains how he got a reluctant witness to return to Alabama to testify.
We tracked Ms. Glenn down in Detroit. My other investigators were working on it, and so they went to Detroit and got Ms. Glenn to agree to let him come out to her house, and they talked to her, and she was very nice to him and served him tea and little cakes and things like that. They came back to Montgomery, and they said they'd found Ms. Glenn, said, "We got good news and bad news. What do you want first?" I said, "Give me the good." He said, "Well, Ms. Glenn positively identified Chambliss and still can pick him out, and she positively identified, just like we had suspected, Blanton's car." And I said, "Well, what in the world can be bad then?" And he said, "Well, she refuses to come back to Alabama. So she's never going to set foot in Alabama again." And back then, in those days, you couldn't require a witness from one state to come to court in another. A subpoena was no good. I told him, I said, "Look, you guys hadn't explained it to her right about what we're doing." And they said, I said, "Tell them this, 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 and this, and go back up there." So they went back, came back and says, "Boss, she is not going to come back to Alabama." And I said, "Well, there's got to be a way now." So I went and got the most outgoing, friendliest of all the black assistants that I had. And I said, "Go back up there and take him." And I brought him in, asked him if he agreed to do it and what he needed to do. I said, "Familiarize yourself with it and go talk this lady into coming." So they went back a third time, and she still wouldn't come. So when they came back, I said, "Oh, well, am I the only one around here that can get things done? What's wrong?" And so we went back. I went over there, and just like they said, she was so nice and good, and she brought out cakes and tea, and I made every argument I could imagine, almost begging and pleading and with her to come back, telling her how important it was, and she wouldn't do it. She said no. I was about to despair and also on the verge of getting angry about it, and I noticed on her coffee table she had an old Jet magazine telling all about the Montgomery bus boycott. So I picked that magazine up and was thumbing through there, and I noticed there were a couple of pictures of Fred Gray. And Fred was by then a good friend of mine, and Fred was also an outstanding lawyer, still is. Fred's picture was in there with Dr. King. He represented Dr. King and Ms. Parks in that Montgomery bus boycott when Ms. Parks got arrested, and then later Dr. King got arrested. And so Fred was pictured in there beside Ms. Parks and beside Dr. King. And so I said, "Ms. Glenn," I said, "you see this guy right here?" I said, "Dr. King, at the birth of the Civil Rights Movement, he trusted and turned to this man, Fred Gray. They followed his advice, and he ultimately prevailed in the U.S. Supreme Court and started us on the road to the progress that we have today." And I said, "If this man that Dr. King trusted so, and Ms. Parks trusted, if he would have come up here and tell you you need to go back to Alabama, would you go?" And she said, "Well, I would certainly consider it." That was such a change from all the times we'd been trying to prevail on her to come. And so I said, "Let's get out of here." So we got out, and I stopped at the first payphone, called Fred and explained it to him. He agreed to drop everything. I sent the state plane down to get him. We went back over there the next day, and ultimately she agreed to come. She was a terrific witness.
That is an amazing story. Who was another key witness?
Well, Chambliss's niece, Elizabeth Cobbs, she, along with Ms. Glenn, were our two best witnesses. And Elizabeth, at the time, had become a Methodist minister and had a church fairly near Legion Field. She and other females in the Chambliss family had been working with us and working with Eddie, and earlier we worked with the FBI. And she had some information about what Chambliss had said the day before the bombing. And we used her, and she was a very effective, most effective witness.
Now, you presented information to the grand jury regarding Chambliss, and you got the indictment. When did you arrest him?
Oh, probably March, approximately, of 77. And then we went to trial in November, as I remember.
Well, let's talk about the trial. You present a pretty strong circumstantial case. You've got Ms. Glenn's testimony putting him and the car there at the scene of the crime. What's some of the testimony from his own family that helped to convict him?
Well, Ms. Cobb, said that a day or two or three before the bombing, there had been an incident where a white girl riding in a bus or a school bus, her arm was out of the bus, and some black guy had stabbed her. I think she had to have three stitches or something, but that set Chambliss off. And Ms. Cobb said that just about drove him crazy. And so we found out that there was an article in the Birmingham News that Chambliss had offered a $1,000 reward for the arrest of whoever that was stabbed this girl. Ms. Cobb said that that upset Chambliss so much that he said, you just wait till Sunday. They'll beg us to segregate after Sunday. And this was like the Friday or the Saturday before the bomb went off on Sunday.
There was one particular cross-examination in the trial that proved to be critical. It was of a Birmingham police officer, I believe.
And that was Chambliss's nephew, who was a Birmingham police officer, and he testified as a defense witness, and I cross-examined him and did a pretty good job. I think probably the best job I've ever done in a court case before or since. And so right after he came down, Art Haynes Sr. and the Haynes's were great lawyers, good friends and tough opponents, but good people. So Art Haynes Sr. stood up and announced that he was calling Bob Chambliss to the stand, and Chambliss had just seen the cross-examination of his nephew, and he said, "Nope, I ain't getting up there." So I said, "What'd he say?" And he said it louder, and he kept repeating it, and the judge got the jury out right quick, but the damage was done. And the reason that was kind of important, he learned first semester in law school that a prosecutor cannot comment on a defendant's failure to testify because the Constitution gives you the right not to, and you can't be used against them that they didn't. So Chambliss did that to himself. All I did, I didn't comment on his failure to take the stand. I just said, "What'd he say? What'd he say?" And he said it a couple more times louder. And so that was a good way for us to end the case, I thought.
Talk about your summation to the jury a little bit.
Well, I was going to do it right after lunch. We had lunch break, and then when we came back to reconvene court, I was the only thing left was my summation and the judge's explanation of the law to the jury. And so I went off by myself and walked around downtown Birmingham trying to get my thoughts in order. And when we came back, I still can't remember whether I had anything to eat or not. But I came in the courtroom right shortly before court was to reconvene, and one of my assistants, John Young, was up there getting all the exhibits lined up and making sure that everything had been offered and admitted and going through everything, making sure there weren't any glitches in what was going to be sent back to the jury. And so when I walked in, he said, Baxley, I've been waiting for you. Come here." And I said, "No, John, I'm busy. I'm getting my thoughts in order. And he said, "Baxley, come here. I want to show you something." I said, "No, John, no." He said, "Baxley, you stubborn old goat, come up here and look at this." So I went up there, and he handed me what had been marked State's Exhibit Number 1, and it was Denise McNair's death certificate. So I looked at it and was very irritable about him, you know, interrupting my train of thought. And I said, "It's Denise's death certificate. So what?" The case we were trying was Denise McNair. I'd broken it up into four separate cases, and we were trying Denise's case. He said, "Baxley, you dunce, look at the date of birth." I looked at the date of birth, and lo and behold, it was that day was her birthday. That had escaped me and everybody else, though Young picked up on it just minutes before I was to start my final argument. So that gave me an ideal way to end my final argument. And I told the jury that they had a chance to do something nobody else would, that look at that Exhibit 1, and you'll see that today was the anniversary of the birth of Denise McNair. Today's her birthday. I said it could have been tonight. Would have been a happy occasion at the McNair house. They would have been celebrations, ice cream, cake, maybe talk about college, talk about work, talk about maybe grandchildren, talk about whatever, but tonight won't be a happy night, and there will be another happy night on this day in the McNair house. but that you jurors will have an opportunity to do something that no other people on this planet will ever have. I said, you'll have an opportunity to give Denise McNair a birthday present, the best one she's ever been able to receive, and one that I believe she'll be aware of. And with all my heart, I believe she'll be aware of it. And that birthday present you can give her is by your verdict, bringing her killer to justice. And so I sat down. That was just a higher power looking after us for Young to find that and show it to me. It certainly wasn't anything that I did or uncovered. And in fact, the coincidence of us going to the jury on the day of her birthday is, the odds of that are pretty long. I'm extremely proud that we had those 12 citizens that had the courage to do what they did. And I hope that during this this period of time, the 50th anniversary, that somebody can give some credit to those jurors that stepped up to the plate.
Former Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxley prosecuted Robert Chambliss in 1977 for the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. Chambliss was sentenced to life in prison. He died in 1985. You're listening to Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, The Case for Justice. For WBHM, I'm Greg Bass. In the next part of our program, we'll talk with T.K. Thorne, author of Last Chance for Justice, How Relentless Investigators Uncovered New Evidence Convicting the Birmingham Church Bombers, and Doug Jones, who prosecuted Thomas Blanton and Bobby Frank Cherry for their part in the bombing. We'll have more after this break. You're listening to Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, The Case for Justice. For WBHM, I'm Greg Bass. T.K. Thorne spent 22 years with the Birmingham Police Department before retiring in 1999 with the rank of captain. Since then, she's written several books, the latest of which is Last Chance for Justice. Over the course of 4 years, she interviewed Ben Heron and Bill Fleming, who were the principal investigators for the trial of Thomas Blanton and Bobby Frank Cherry, the two surviving suspects in the case. Thorne explains why the case was reopened in 1995.
Rob Lankford was the FBI special agent in charge, the SAC, in the 1990s. He had just come to town. And he also felt this barrier of communication and distrust, especially between the African-American community and law enforcement. And so he wanted to start open up some channels of communication, and he reached out to the clergy, the black clergy in Birmingham. And eventually he was able to convince them, although they were very reluctant at first, to come to the FBI office and sit down with him and talk to him. And during that conversation, Reverend Abraham Woods burst out in a spontaneous comment, which was, why didn't the FBI investigate the bombing case? They never did anything. Or words to that effect. And Lankford was surprised, and he promised that he would look into it. And he made good on his promise. He had the files, or some of the files, brought to him, and he looked through it, and he said, well, there's certainly a lot of material here. Why don't we take another look? And it was really just that simple. So he opened the case, and he invited the police department to come in as a partner.
The Birmingham police selected Detective Ben Heron to work with the FBI, and veteran agent Bill Fleming was the choice to represent the Bureau. According to Thorne, neither of them was excited about the assignment.
Not at all. Bill Fleming, in the FBI, agent who, even though it was logical for him to have the case because he headed up the civil rights unit in the FBI, but he was also the senior agent in the department, and he thought that this was a boondoggle. He thought they were giving it to him because he was the oldest person and it really didn't matter. So he was very resentful at first about it. Ben Heron wanted to know who he'd made mad. But he went over to the FBI and he worked on it, and he came back and Chief Johnson said, "Well, you're the one that knows what they've got. What do you think we should do?" And Ben had been really torn about it because on the one hand, there were over 100 witnesses that had already died and some suspects that had died. There was no indication that there was any new evidence or any way to get new evidence. So he really didn't have a lot of hope that anything was going to happen. On the other hand, he knew that this was the very last chance to find justice. And he felt that he would like to represent the Birmingham Police Department and do the very best job he could.
Heron and Fleming spent the first 18 months of the investigation reviewing all these FBI files from the 60s. What did they find?
First of all, let me say that there were thousands of pages of information. The FBI had seated informants in the Klan for years, and all of that was also available. But they pretty quickly narrowed down to a core group, the Eastview 13, Clavern here in Birmingham, and the splinter group of the Cahaba Boys. Heron went through all this documentation with an open mind. He did not look at it from the perspective of, we're going to just look at those suspects that the FBI came up with in the 60s. He just started from scratch, and he followed a lot of what he called rabbit trails, that he got excited and thought, there's something that they've overlooked, and he would get excited and tell his partner that, and Fleming would say, wait till you get to the next, volume of information. And sure enough, they would have chased that to the end. So they ended up basically with the same. At that time, it was originally four suspects. One had died, Herman Cash. Of course, Robert Chambliss had been prosecuted by Bill Baxley in 1977 and convicted. And then they had the two other suspects, Bobby Frank Cherry and Thomas Blanton. And they felt that they had, just like the investigators in the 60s, they felt that these two were the right people.
Bill Baxley had always been a hero, a political hero of mine. So it was an easy decision for me as a second-year law student at Cumberland Law School to cut classes, to go watch.
Doug Jones was named United States Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama in 1997. He watched from the balcony as Bill Baxley prosecuted Robert Chambliss in the 1977 trial. More than two decades later, Jones would finish the job Baxley began.
1974 had the opportunity to spend a little time with a Supreme Court Justice, William O. Douglas. And his advice to me, who as someone who wanted to be a good trial lawyer, was to go watch trials, watch what good lawyers do in plying their trades. And so it was an easy decision for me to cut classes that week and watch Baxley. And having an opportunity to sit in that courtroom in the balcony, on the first row of the balcony, as Bill presented that case and did the closing argument, and watch how riveting it was, how emotional it was. It truly changes your perspective about a number of things, including Birmingham, including its history, but more importantly, about the system of justice that we have in this country and what I wanted to do as a lawyer. So when I learned just before I became the United States Attorney that this case had been reopened, and it was the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Department of Justice, an office that I was just about to lead, that was going to be doing this case. There was just something that seemed to have lined up perfectly that said, this is a case that was meant for the kid sitting in the balcony 24 years earlier.
In the summer of 1997, Jones says the case began to crack.
The biggest break came from a strategic decision made in consultation with Bob Eddy, who had been Bill Baxley's investigative guy, that before any of this gets public, to go out to Maybank, Texas, and try to interview Bobby Frank Cherry, who Bob Eddy was convinced was just on the verge of trying to confess or help in the investigations in the 1970s. And they went out there, they interviewed Cherry. They spent hours with Cherry. He had not changed a bit. He was still braggadocious. He was still a racist. He said a number of things that helped us, that we used at trial. But the most important thing he did was afterwards, he called a press conference. And when the press was shown in Birmingham and in Texas, that's when the phone started ringing. One of the first people that called was his granddaughter, Teresa, who said, thank God somebody is looking at this case, and went on to tell us how he used to brag about being part of the group that bombed the church, about being part of the group and how they terrorized the black community. From the media that we had from that press conference and others, we had witnesses that came forward, an ex-wife of Cherry's. It was his third wife. Her name was Willa Dean. She saw a newspaper article in the fall of 98 about this investigation and literally read about it, had thought that Bob Cherry had gone to jail 30 years earlier for this bombing, picked up the phone, called the FBI in Montana, and went out to see him. My agents flew out there from Birmingham, probably beat her there. They were so excited to have found her. And she talked about how his car broke down by the church. And when she went to pick him up, he was pointing to the spot near the church where they built the bomb. She introduced us to her brother, who Cherry also made admissions to, things that he would say, you know, that the bomb didn't go up off when it was supposed to. And in the very next breath, speak as only somebody like Bobby Frank Cherry could speak about the African-American community and say, well, at least they can't breed. We had a young man who was in the Cherry household the weekend before the bombing and saw Bob Cherry and others around the kitchen table talking about the bomb being ready, and talking about the 16th Street Baptist Church. All of these people came forward. The last one that I think is the most interesting probably was a fellow named Michael Goins, who is deceased now. And Michael was living in Texas in 1980. And Michael called us and then later testified about a conversation he had with Cherry in 1980 when they were in Dallas, Texas. Cherry had a carpet cleaning business. And Michael was cleaning some apartments and Cherry was cleaning the carpet. And in what I think is such an ironic conversation for today's politics, they're talking about the rise of the Hispanic population in Dallas, Texas in 1980 and all complaining about it and wondering what to do about it. And Cherry makes the comment, and this is the testimony, so I hate to even use the language, but it's the testimony. And Cherry says, well, we just need to do to the Mexicans what we did to the niggers in Birmingham. And that just kind of set the stage. And I think that that's just such an important statement about the past and how we can apply the lessons to the future.
You're listening to Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, The Case for Justice. For WBHM, I'm Greg Bass. We're talking with former U.S. Attorney Doug Jones, who prosecuted Thomas Blanton and Bobby Frank Cherry for the bombing. While Jones and the investigators were building the case against Cherry, the trail leading to the other suspect was proving to be more elusive.
Blanton was a lot different as we were approaching that case. The evidence against him was considerably different than it was because Blanton didn't run his mouth. He had not made the kind of admissions that we had with Cherry. We found a former postal worker named James Lay, who proved to be a very instrumental witness in trying to get the indictment. Because 2 weeks before the bombing, James Lay is riding down 16th Street in Birmingham. He's part of a group, a civil defense group, that was, you know, their job was to protect the homes of the preachers, the civil rights leaders, the churches at night because there had been so many attacks and so many bombings. James Lay is driving down 16th Street by the church at 1 o'clock in the morning, just a couple of weeks before the bombing, and he sees a car parked by the side of the church, and there's two white men there. One's by the car, and the second one is standing over by the steps where the bomb was later placed, and that man was holding a grip, what Mr. Lay called a grip. It would have been a satchel or a backpack or something. And he hit his bright lights, and they take off, and they call the police, and the police didn't make a report. At the time, they just said, I'm going home, boy. You didn't see a damn thing. But 2 weeks later, he is not far from the bombing when it happens. He helps remove the bodies of the children. He tells the FBI what he saw. They take him up. They confirm it with the police. And then they show him pictures of a number of Klansmen. And the ones he said resembled the people standing out that night were Bob Chambliss, who he said was the guy at the car. And then the person that he identified as being holding a grip, standing by those steps, was Tommy Blanton. That's incredibly strong circumstantial evidence. And Mr. Lay testified at our grand jury and was extremely strong witness for us. We found a former girlfriend of Blanton's. We had his ex-wife that were all set in one form or fashion to put the case together for him. But the real critical piece of evidence against Blanton came from the FBI vault room that we found after we indicted the cases, and that was what has been called the kitchen sink tape. John Colvin, who was an FBI employee, rented the apartment next to Tommy Blanton and his wife, pretending to be a truck driver, and they tore out a wall in a closet that shared a wall with the Blanton kitchen. And there was a hole underneath the kitchen sink, and that's where they put a little microphone right next to that hole, ran it to a tape recorder, ran it to a telephone line that then went back to a tape recorder back in the FBI office. And they caught on tape a really significant tape in June of 64 in which Blanton and his wife are talking about that weekend. And he says on three occasions, you know, I was making the bomb. We were planning the bomb. We were having that meeting to make the bomb.
That crucial tape almost didn't make it to trial. Agent Bill Fleming found the transcript of the tape, but the transcript was not admissible as evidence. Author T.K. Thorne explains what Fleming did next.
He had asked the file clerk, who was in charge of all the evidence, twice to go look for these tapes, and they had found some tapes, but not the crucial one that they were really looking for. And so Fleming decided, well, I'll just go look myself. And he went down there and he looked everywhere. He couldn't find it. He was about to give up and walk out of the room when he noticed a box in a corner, a dusty box that looked like it was about to go out with the trash. Just to be thorough, he went and looked at it. And lo and behold, it was boxes of these huge reel-to-reel tapes that they used back then.
That one tape was very powerful. But there was another very important witness in the Blanton case, and that was Mitchell Burns. Mitchell Burns was a Klansman who became an informant after an FBI agent named Brooke Blake. He took him home one day and stopped on the side of the road and showed him the pictures of these dead children in the morgue at what's then Hillman Hospital, now UAB Hospital. And for a couple of years, Mitch rode around with Blanton. They took his car, Mitchell's car, in which the FBI had placed one of those recorders. And we played a number of excerpts from those tape recordings. No smoking gun on the tapes, although Blanton would talk about things he would do when he bombed his next church. He would talk about how he liked to go bombing. There was one time when they could not get the approval to turn the recorder on, where they went to pick up Bob Cherry. And as they pull in an alley, Blanton says, this is the alley I almost missed the night that we bombed the church. And inside, Cherry talks about throwing the FBI off track of where the bomb was made. So Mitchell Burns, in addition to the tape recording, was a very, very important witness in the Blanton case. We indicted Cherry and Blanton together in May of 2000. And we immediately moved to consolidate the cases for trial, which the judge granted. We started the motion process, and at some point, unbeknownst to the prosecution, The defense had approached Judge Garrett, as they could legally do without our knowledge, to apprise him of a situation involving Cherry's competency. And at some point, that became public, and they filed a motion saying that Bob Cherry was not competent to stand trial. Not being competent to stand trial really means that he is not competent at the time of trial and doesn't understand the nature of the proceedings against him and cannot participate.
You're listening to Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, The Case for Justice. For WBHM, I'm Greg Bass. We're talking with attorney Doug Jones, who prosecuted Thomas Blanton and Bobby Frank Cherry. Tommy Blanton was convicted of first-degree murder in 2001. Before Cherry could be brought to trial, the issue of his competency had to be settled.
Under the Alabama law, there was a real question about his competency, and the judge ordered him to go to the state mental facility in Tuscaloosa, which was the Taylor Hardin mental facility, where he was evaluated for about 70 days. And it was clear to us all along that Cherry was faking his dementia issues. But after he was observed for 70 days, it became, without question, medically clear that he had been faking it and was perfectly competent, knew everything about the trial. And so judge ruled him competent to stand trial. That's when he set the case for trial. We tried it about a year after the Blanton case.
And Cherry is convicted largely through his own words, isn't he?
Yes. Between the agents who testified, who came from all over the country, retired FBI agents, who came from all over the country to talk about Cherry's inconsistencies and what I consider just to be lies to the FBI. That was a huge point. He made certain admissions. For instance, he had admitted to the FBI and when Ben Heron and Bob Eddy interviewed him in 97, that he had been part of the group that attacked Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth in 1957. That was the agent testimony and all the lies and inconsistencies. And then you couple that with the admissions, the bragging ways that Cherry had talked about this church bombing over the years. His own words were the most damning thing that came back to haunt him and I think caused his conviction.
There were a number of people who were Klan wives, relatives of Klan members, who were terrified in the 60s and 70s and would not testify for good reason. They
yes.
were scared to death.
Yeah.
That was less the case in the 1990s and in 2000.
It was less the case, but at the same time, you know, there were still a number of the Klan wives who were alive when we were doing our grand jury, and we didn't get any help from any of those people. We had them in my office. We would separate them from their husbands and try to talk to them separately and play on their sympathies and talk about the deaths of children. And by this time, folks were grandmothers and grandfathers, and it just had no effect whatsoever. So there was still a lot of that. You know, I sometimes say that those old Klansmen were just really not warm-blooded animals, and they had ice water in their veins, and they refused to talk and to give us any information or any help. We were able to loosen up with a couple of witnesses. I mean, Blanton's ex-wife helped us some. She did identify the voices on the tape, but she maintained all along that she couldn't remember that conversation, and that she couldn't authenticate it and maintain that Tommy had never told her about it, even though there was some evidence that he actually took her down underneath the Cahaba River Bridge one time to talk about the Cahaba River Boys and how they would meet under the bridge and plot their violence against black folks. We found an ex-girlfriend who was a former military personnel who had retired from the military living in South Alabama. And I'll never forget when we rode down there, we didn't tell her we were coming, and she was standing on the porch of her little mobile home. And as I walked up, I said, I'm Doug Jones. I'm the United States attorney in Birmingham. And she just smiled and said, I've been expecting you, Mr. Jones, because she had seen the media. And she talked about how Blanton would try to run black men over in his car when they'd go out on dates, and it would scare her, and how he would take her to Klan meetings, and how he would take acid and stop at a little grocery store in the black neighborhoods and pour on the meat counters. It was just, you know, these were haters. They were ugly, ugly people.
Why did it take so long to bring these people to justice?
Well, it's a good question. It's a question that I think and we get asked all the time, and it's a hard question to answer. To begin with, people have to remember that the killing of these four children, even though Birmingham had become known as Bombingham and the black community known as Dynamite Hill, there had not been any deaths from any of these bombings. We had a few minor injuries, but nothing significant, whether it was Arthur Shore's home or A.D. King's home, Reverend Shuttlesworth's home. And now, all of a sudden, on September 15th, 1963, you have a bombing of a church in which four children, innocent children, died. And all of a sudden, the world changed. And I think it changed in the eyes of not only the community, but also a significant number of the Klansmen and their wives who were there, because no one wanted anything to do with this. So despite an incredible effort by the FBI, and I do mean an incredible effort, they had boots on the ground in Birmingham, Alabama, within minutes and certainly within hours after this bombing, tracking down every lead, chasing leads all over the country. People clammed up. People shut up. They didn't want to have anything to do with this. And we couldn't prove at the time, the FBI couldn't prove what explosive material was used. They tried their best to do that. But I think it was, despite the effort, everywhere you turned, the Klan was saying, it's not any of me. I don't know anything about it. I was so-and-so. I was around. And it was all the denials. And I think because of that, the case just couldn't be made. It was not one that was going to be made for some length of time. And it's like so many other homicides. There are literally thousands of homicide cases in this country that don't get solved ever, but some of them get solved later as time passes. And I think that that's what happened here. Time passed, people loosened up. You had witnesses that came forward that helped Baxley that were a little more reluctant to do so in the 1960s. The defendants, people like Cherry, got a little looser with their lips. The more time passed, the more emboldened they got and empowered they got that they could talk about this, because they didn't feel like anything would happen to them. And I think the final thing was really Birmingham changed. I know in the Blanton case, in the closing argument, the defense lawyer who did a wonderful job in the case asked the jury, you know, what has changed? Because in the Blanton case, we had so much old evidence. What's changed? You know, why are we here now? What has changed from the 1960s? And my response in my part of the closing was, it was very simple. We have changed. All you had to do was look around the courtroom and see black and white, young and old. You could look in the jury and see black and white, young and old. So I think the biggest thing that changed was an attitude of the community in Birmingham and an acceptance of civil rights, an acceptance of a diverse community, of integration, to where people looked at this evidence and would look at it fairly, objectively. We never expected the jury to give us a break as prosecutors simply because this was a historical case. All we ever asked was that people look at it objectively and don't look at it through the lens of a segregationist that would have likely have sat on the jury in the 1960s. So it truly was a combination of events that it dealt with a case, with the facts, and ultimately with this community.
Of the four people suspected by the FBI to have participated in the bombing, three were tried, convicted, and imprisoned. Robert Chambliss went to jail in 1977 and died in custody in 1985. Tommy Blanton was convicted in 2001 and is serving a life term today. Bobby Frank Cherry was convicted in 2002 and died in prison in 2004. Herman Cash died in 1994, having never been charged. But with the delay between the commission of the crime and the conviction of the criminals, one might well ask, was justice served? Birmingham News reporter Burnett Wright.
I believe justice was served because you still have one of the bombers still incarcerated. We had an article published in the Birmingham News and on AL.com that there's a bomber still in St. Clair Correctional Facility who spends most of his time in his jail cell. He does not come out. He's afraid for his life. The other bombers have died. You have to give Mr. Doug Jones credit for prosecuting these cases. Former Attorney General Mr. Baxley, for also bringing us to the court system. Birmingham today is far, far, far better. There's no question than the Birmingham of 50 years ago. However, I don't think anything will ever be perfect. There will always be steps that can be taken. But I think what we've seen is that a lot of those steps are moving in the right direction. It's not going backwards. It's going forward. And I think that's a good sign.
That's an interesting question. Do I think like justice was finally done?
Bombing survivor Barbara Cross.
I'll put it like this. Someone said you can pass laws, but you can't legislate people's hearts. I would be naive if I thought racism still didn't exist. As I tell people today, the Klan are not behind the robes. They're in business suits. Yes, racism is still out there. The signs have disappeared in Birmingham. I don't see the colored and white signs anymore. But I know hatred is still out there. So I just wish that people would remember the lesson for that day, a love that forgives, the type of agape love, that whatever somebody does something to you, that you can forgive them. I'd like to think that finally, that just some type of justice had been done.
Yes. I'm going to be emphatic that justice was served.
Again, Prosecutor Doug Jones.
You know, there was a delay. And really, you know, we hear justice delayed is justice denied. Well, I think the original quote was that there is injustice in the delay. And certainly there was some injustice in this delay because you had both Blanton and Cherry who got to live out lives and have families and jobs that these four children and their families never had the opportunity to. So there was a sense there was some injustice. However, I would quickly point out that I am convinced that had these cases been brought precipitously in the 1960s, they would have likely resulted in not guilty verdicts, which meant that double jeopardy would have attached and neither Bill Baxley nor myself would have ever had the opportunity to prosecute these guys. And I think that with not every case being able to be prosecuted, that justice ended up being served. There is a reason, and I've said this for many, many years, there is a reason that there is no statute of limitations for murder, much less the murder of children. Sometimes it takes time. It is one of those situations that things have to come up in the right place, fall just right for you. The planets line up, however you want to see it. Some would say a divine power helping you oversee some of this. And that's what happened here. And I think it took the time for Birmingham to not heal from the church bombing, but to certainly move a little bit forward and to let people get more used to the diversity that we now celebrate in this city so that people can look at things objectively. So at the end of the day, justice was delayed, but it was certainly not denied.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
You've been listening to Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, The Case for Justice. We spoke with attorneys Bill Baxley and Doug Jones, who prosecuted the bombers. We talked with bombing survivor Barbara Cross, journalist Burnett Wright, author of 1963, How the Birmingham Civil Rights Movement Changed America and the World, and T.K. Thorne, author of Last Chance for Justice. Special thanks to Courtney Hayden and Boutwell Studios for their recording assistance. For WBHM, additional editing and production from Rachel Lindley and Michael Crowell. WBHM's general manager is Scott Hanley.
A long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
For WBHM, I'm Greg Bass.